All right. Welcome, listeners, to episode 108 of Know Your Enemy. I'm Matt Sittman, your podcast co-host, and I'm here, as always, with my great friend, Sam Etherbell. Hey, Sam.
Hi, Matt.
How are you doing today?
I'm good. It's January 19th, so it's the day before Donald Trump's re-inauguration.
Well, I have to say, it's been a dark and dreary day in Rome, so this is kind of like transatlantic weather-based sympathy with what you're all enduring. It's dark and gloomy here, but the podcast is pressing on. We have a lot of great episodes lined up that we're very excited about. We won't talk about them yet, but we're here to introduce one we recorded just a few days ago, and it was a conversation with our friend Eric Baker. Listeners might remember him from our Bomb Power episode on Gary Wills. Eric just came out with a new book called Make Your Own Job, How the Entrepreneurial Work Ethic Exhausted America. He's also a lecturer in the history of science at Harvard University. His writings appeared all over the place. The Drift, N Plus One, Harper's, The New Yorker, and he's also an associate editor at The Drift. So Eric was a great guest. We loved his book.
Yeah, you can tell from the title, this is a book about Americans' relationship to work, and in particular, the entrepreneurial idea, this idea of the ideal worker as well as the ideal manager as someone who is creative and innovative and disruptive, who loves their work, who loves their own job, and in many cases, as the title suggests, makes their own job. So it's all the kind of workplace career self-help nostrums about believing in yourself, and that's how you are successful in the American economy, making your job be something that reflects your true self and your personality, and all these ideas that we might think of as basically just sort of like self-evident good advice in the American economy, but actually have this really fascinating history and genealogy in the 20th century, which involves a lot of know your enemy appropriate right-wing thinkers, but also a lot of things we haven't talked about on the podcast, like sort of popular psychology and management science, and really like self-help literature. Some of the books that have sold more copies than any book in American history, which many, many people in this country have read over the years to inform their conception of what it means to be involved in the American economy, whether at the bottom or at the top.
Yes. Eric's book was incredibly rich. We praise it at the start of the conversation and throughout, so we don't need to dwell on it too much longer here, but just really do consider checking Eric's book out. And Sam, as you alluded to, we do end up talking about the Koch brothers, the Austrian School of Economics, pretty canonical figures in the Know Your Enemy cinematic universe through this fascinating angle of Eric's book.
And I will say one other thing, which is that if you're thinking, well, is this kind of a strange episode to be coming out on the occasion of Donald Trump's inauguration? I actually don't think it is. Where we end up is very much with Donald Trump. And I don't want to give too much away, but if you think about the way that Donald Trump talks about himself, about his work, about his success, there is a way in which Donald Trump represents really like the zenith of this kind of thinking in American life. And we're all living in Donald Trump's world now. So it makes very good sense to understand where his ideas about himself and his accomplishments come from.
Yes. And as we know, there are at least a few entrepreneurs hanging around with him these days, to say the least. Well, should we get some housekeeping items, Sam?
Yes.
As always, we're grateful to our partners at Dissent. One thing they do for us is they sponsor the podcast, and that means if you subscribe to Know Your Enemy on patreon.com/knowyourenemy for $10 a month or more, you get access to not only all of our bonus episodes, but a free digital subscription to Dissent. And also at that $10 a month level, you have access to our Discord. So please do consider signing up for that. And as always, for $5 a month, if you sign up on our Patreon, you get access to all of our bonus episodes, of which there's been some great ones lately and some great ones coming down the pike. So do consider subscribing to Know Your Enemy.
And I'm sure as the Trump White House gets going, if you're looking for more uncut rank punditry, we'll be doing some of that on the Patreon. So sign up for that.
Yeah, we can't help it. We got to try to figure it out. I can't turn away. So we'll be talking about quite a bit on the podcast in the weeks ahead.
And as always, we want to thank Jesse Brenneman, our intrepid producer, as well as Will Epstein, who does the music for the podcast.
That's right. Well, shall we get to it?
Yeah.
Here is our conversation with Eric Baker about his fantastic new book, Make Your Own Job, How the Entrepreneurial Work Ethic Exhausted America.
Enjoy.
All right, let's get started. We're very happy to welcome back to the podcast our friend Eric Baker. Welcome.
Hi, folks. Great to be back on.
Hi, Eric. The man of the hour.
That's right. We're very excited, not just to talk to you, Eric, but because it's an auspicious occasion to do so, which is the publication of your first book, Make Your Own Job, How the Entrepreneurial Work Ethic Exhausted America. It's literally just out from Harvard University Press. So big congratulations.
Thanks so much. I think this is clearly the news event of this week that the nation's attention is fixed on.
That's right. The political world has its eyes fixed on young Eric Baker and his new book.
Eric Baker and Pete Hegseth, the two protagonists of history. We warned you, Eric, that we were going to be effusive in our praise for this book, but I will get some of that out of the way right now. We usually only have authors on who we expect to love their book, and we thought that we would in this case because we love you and you're so brilliant. We love all your other writing. And, you know, I didn't know exactly what to expect from it, but it was extremely helpful, surprising, relevant to lots of things I'm thinking about on a regular basis. And also, I just have to say, because our listeners care about this kind of thing, so incredibly well written, just on a line-to-line basis. And for an academic text produced out of an enormous amount of research on your part, the care that you take with language in this book is something I am so, so grateful for.
Well, I really appreciate that. As I said to you, Sam, when I was writing this book, especially the strands of the book that relate to the history of conservatism, which we'll dive into, I definitely thought of you both.
I was going to joke that I totally disagreed with Sam, but I can't even make a joke. I totally agree with Sam. The quality of the writing really is incredible, not just because there's great sentences, you know, like lovingly and brilliantly crafted and executed sentences, but the clarity with which you marshal your years of research and kind of organize your thoughts and explain, unfold a certain logic, really. I was truly, truly impressed. And so, listeners, please do consider picking it up, buying it. Let's make this an unexpected bestseller. As two entrepreneurs, Sam and I are small business owners, we want to help put the message of this book into practice, Eric, and help you achieve success thought and make some money as a small-scale entrepreneur yourself, an entrepreneur of ideas.
Oh, yes. Yeah. As one of the early self-help tracks that appears briefly in this book, as the title puts it, dollars want me.
I should also say, Eric, I think one reason I was especially absorbed by this is, you know, I have mentioned on the podcast before a little bit of my family economic background and that my father, you know, worked in a factory, PPG, Pittsburgh Plate and Glass Factory, for I think close to 20 years before he started his own small business, very small business. It's still just him. But that was the fulcrum of my father's life, leaving the factory job that everyone told him he was stupid and an idiot for leaving, a good paying job, right, that had health insurance and everything. It was a very good job by the standards of central PA where I grew up. And my dad kind of having the courage to say, no, like he could do more than that. And he left that job and started his own business. Like my dad is an entrepreneur, in other words. I heard so many stories from him about his thought process behind that. And he had me read a lot of the self-help books that he read. I unwittingly was imbibing a sort of version of New Thought, which we'll explain in a little bit, you know, almost from my father. But one of the lines my father would say to me over and over again, and this is in the context of, you know, no matter how hard it was to make ends meet when he first started his business, he would say, Matt, I can tell you this, the man who loves his job never truly works. And on page 4 of this book, you mention a quote from Elon Musk. He tweeted in 2018, nobody ever changed the world on 40 hours a week. But if you love what you do, it mostly doesn't feel like work. And so I thought, my God, this book, among many other things, if you need a top line reason to read it, listeners, this book explains why my father, a working class guy in central Pennsylvania, views work in the exact same way as the world's richest man.
Exactly. I think that's such a great summary of exactly what I was trying to do with this book, is to sort of show the propagation of these ideas kind of across American class hierarchy, and in the process to show how that propagation has made it harder to see class for people wherever they're situated kind of along that line.
There's a wonderful line of Eric's crafting from the book where he writes, "Entrepreneurship is the way that capitalist society dreams of classlessness."
Okay, we can wrap up this conversation. That's what the book's about.
But before we get into the meat of the book, I think it would make sense to hear from you, Eric. You know, what is entrepreneurialism, or the entrepreneurial work ethic, as you call it variously in the book? You know, what distinguishes it from other conceptions of what it means to work in American culture, and why did it capture your attention?
So the way that I like to explain the contrast between entrepreneurialism and the kind of previous incarnation of the American work ethic, which I call industriousness or the industrious work ethic, there's a popular self-help pamphlet actually written by a Scottish man. This text became successful in the United States in the early Gilded Age in the late 19th century, whose title was Blessed Be Drudgery. And I think for a lot of people, when they think about the work ethic, that's really kind of what they have in mind. You know, nose to the grindstone, you know, put your head down it, you know, if the work sucks, it doesn't matter. You still just got to plod on and just, you know, do the unpleasant work that's all around it.
If we say someone has a good work ethic, that's what they mean.
Yeah.
They do view the drudgery as blessed in the sense of they're going to keep doing it every day, onward and upward, keep at it, do your duty.
Exactly, exactly. And so the development of the entrepreneurial work ethic, I think, really begins with the question, what happens when you don't even have drudgery? What happens when it seems like the drudgery that was so perhaps painfully abundant to an earlier generation of working people becomes scarce and there's all kinds of unpleasant work to do one day, but then, you know, you wake up the next and the factory's closed or relocated or an industry has kind of collapsed. You know, this sort of experience of the disappearance of work, it has a much deeper history than I think a lot of people appreciate. I find elements already around the turn of the 20th century, and that's kind of when I think you start to see people taking up these ideas that, you know, what it means to be a good worker, a successful worker, a virtuous worker, is not just doing your duty, it's not just submitting to the drudgery, but it's about creating work.
Making your own job.
Making your own job, exactly. Yeah. And I'm sure, you know, some readers will get tired of it, but, you know, this slogan appears throughout the entire 20th century. And I picked it for the title because it really does kind of distill this idea.
And Eric, so in some ways what you're relaying is that what you were describing as industriousness, what most people think of when you say someone has a good work ethic, right? That was kind of an ideology, a work ethic for an age of abundant work. So industrial revolution, lots of menial jobs. And in fact, the problem was there's so many jobs, you know, they're not that hard to get. Some people might not be very motivated.
Right? Yes.
When they show up, you know, to their grim, terrible factory every morning for a whatever, 15-hour shift, right? How do you get those people to kind of embrace doing these horrible menial jobs that are so abundant, like inculcating some work ethic that says, no, no, keep showing up. You're a good person if you show up and keep doing this. And the rise of entrepreneurial work ethic, well, how would you describe kind of the material conditions that accompany the rise of entrepreneurial work ethic as it's kind of eclipsing the old industriousness and the conditions that were related to that industriousness?
Yeah, so fundamentally, it occurs when the sort of infrastructural development of American industry gets to a place where you can start to increase productivity significantly without bringing on a bunch of new workers. So this really kind of comes to fruition on an economy-wide scale in the 1920s, in the period after World War I, where you get a huge expansion in industrial output without net additions to the industrial workforce. You know, and there are a variety of reasons for that economic historians have gone into. But, you know, for my purposes, the causes are in some ways less important than the consequences, you know, which are that we need to find some other way to employ people. There's a rhetoric at this time, the problem of production having been solved. You know, this sort of great task of how to make as much stuff as anyone could possibly want. You know, we've figured out how to do that. So now what? And that's really kind of when, you know, again, sort of no matter where you're situated in American class hierarchy, whether you're a precarious unemployed worker, you know, trying to make ends meet, or whether you're a titan of industry who's maybe presiding over one of these industries that's kind of at risk of obsolescence or overproduction, the imperative is, you know, come up with new work to do. And to do that sustainably, you kind of need to draw on other kinds of resources. You need to kind of cultivate this practice of sort of marshaling the resources of your selfhood or, you know, your ideas, you know, kind of connecting with some sort of source of new ideas so you can kind of ceaselessly funnel them into the creation of new work.
Well, so we've kind of identified then what creates the necessity for this way of thinking, but I don't think we've yet defined kind of its contours. And obviously, one of the things about this book is that it's a mutable discourse, entrepreneurialism. It changes in response to different needs in the economy. You know, one of the things that I wrote down was that there's a way in which entrepreneurialism is this sort of distinctive but mutable, recurring or cyclical discourse. It reemerges at various moments to resolve or harmonize some contradiction or structural inadequacy in the patterns of American work. That's the necessity. But just for the listeners and acknowledging that it's going to change and morph over the course of the conversation, over the course of the 20th century, could you just give us some descriptors of what the texture of this ideology is? What are people meant to think about work and what they're doing when they're working?
Yeah, totally. So again, the tautological way that I would describe it is
entrepreneurs are entrepreneurial.
Right, exactly. I mean, part of the task of defining that is to kind of think about the other virtues that are sort of bundled up in this concept, you know, what it sort of emerges to sort of describe. So creativity is a big one. Leadership is another. I mean, it often, as I describe in the book, in the early 20th century, leadership and entrepreneurship were often used basically interchangeably. Innovation, eventually in kind of more recent self-help, the idea of being proactive. You know, you're not just responding to circumstances. You're creating your own circumstances.
Infusing your work with your personality in some way, as opposed to the drudgery of the kind of old industriousness, right, which was kind of rote.
Exactly.
Well, I want to say, for potential readers and for the sake of this conversation, the very, very beginning of your book begins with a death. The death of Tony Hsieh, the Zappos entrepreneur. He has an enormous amount of success as an entrepreneur. He's really representative of the 21st century concept of the entrepreneur, this internet guru. He propagates a lot of this thought, encourages it in the employees. The enterprise of Zappos is supposed to be representative of this innovative business where everybody who works there is super engaged, has intrinsic motivation to be a part of the project. And then he kind of like starts indulging further and further in drugs and partying, gets kind of obsessed with strange bodily practices, depriving himself of oxygen, and dies in a fire under circumstances that are a little bit unclear whether it was on purpose or not on his part. And I have to say that this idea of this person who reaches the kind of apotheosis of success under the entrepreneurial work ethic as it flourishes in its fully florid and bleak dimensions in our time, it makes the whole book have a sort of sinister cast. It's almost like the book is a murder mystery. Like we find a body at the beginning of this book. And I have to say that this is very effective to me because his death, it casts this shadow over the rest of the contents, which at certain times can seem kind of innocuous or banal. Because these sort of self-help nostrums, these ideas about self-actualization, about determination, about self-belief that are the sort of texture of entrepreneurialism, they're so, at this point in our lives and in the life of American work, so the water that we swim in. They're so core to American capitalism's authorizing myths that they can seem self-evident. Like the kinds of things that Matt's father would say, or that we constantly read on like X threads by like success gurus about believing in yourself and being creative, and that's what makes you a good, successful worker or entrepreneur in this economy. It can be hard to perceive them as a form of ideological conditioning because they have achieved a kind of hegemonic common sense. So it can be hard to perceive them as potentially oppressive and sinister. But the fact of putting Tony Hsieh's death at the beginning of your book means that as I'm reading this book, I'm going, where is this going? And I can feel, you can kind of see the shadow, the sinister shadow cast by all of these concepts, because we know that in our time, this kind of frantic injunction to work all the time and believe in your work and love your work does have an oppressive dimension. It does exhaust us, and it does lead us to profound dissatisfactions with our lives. Like, having that kind of bleakness in mind as you read these sunny, banal nostrums about
power of positive thinking,
about the power of positive thinking. I just wanted to say that as an effective writing strategy, you know, craft narrative strategy for you, Eric, but also for the listeners to understand that, like, where we're heading is to a very bleak place. You know, the place where somebody who achieves success on these terms to the highest degree nonetheless ends up burning alive, depriving himself of oxygen for some reason, maybe because his life represented the obscene excess of the entrepreneurial work ethic, or perhaps because somebody who achieves at that level then needs some kind of release from the effects of this frantic way of being on one's life, body, and mind, that there's some kind of stillness that becomes precious and desirable. And I just wanted to say that we're going to be talking about these things, and you're going to be thinking to yourself, listeners, like, well, of course, yeah, you should make your own job. Yeah, of course, it's good to be creative. Yeah, it's good to be innovative. Yeah, it's good to believe in yourself. It's good to feel that the work that you're doing represents something true and beautiful about yourself. But these banalities have a very bleak and perhaps even evil underside.
Yeah. You know, I read that opening chapter and I actually wrote down, I kind of see where this is all going, which is that, like, making your own job eventually, because, you know, the era we're living in is like the kind of hellscape, like culmination of so many terrible trends, right? A number of which are described in this book. It's like the kind of ultimate cash out of the entrepreneurial work ethic is like these influencers I see online whose lives seem so miserable to me, where like your life literally does become your job, right? Like your literal life, you know, posting photos of you with your boyfriend on vacation because you're like an insta-gay couple, right?
Yeah.
And like, it seems so miserable to me. This is an exhausting proposition. And at least according to my like spiritual and moral values, like there is no chance it will ever provide you true happiness and consolation in this life, right? Like it just never will. And you can see how jobs then colonize more and more of like our everyday lives and consciousness until like everything you do is your job because you're posting about it to sell products or something, you know, like the ratcheting up until the kind of entrepreneurial work ethic just totally takes over. Like your life is your job. Your job is your life. And the kind of merging between the two, there's no daylight.
Yeah. As Tom Peters wrote in 1997, we are CEOs of our own companies. Me, Inc.
Oof. Yes. I hate it.
To be in business today, our most important job is to be head marketer for the brand called you.
Oof, oof, oof.
You know, I started working on this project a long time ago. I was a couple years out of college and grad school, and you know, for myself and, you know, all of my other friends in our, you know, early mid-20s, kind of starting in this world of professional work after college, I mean, we were all just absolutely fucking miserable. I remember a conversation with a friend who was in college. He was a very idealistic guy, you know, involved in sort of student activism projects that I was also involved in. And he wound up taking a corporate job at Amazon in Seattle. And I remember having a conversation with him about the film adaptation of Jeff Vandermeer's novel Annihilation. And at the climax of that movie, Natalie Portman, she goes into this kind of sinister, dark, empty pit. And in there, she encounters essentially a clone of herself, this sort of mysterious body that takes on her form in this dark pit. And my friend, who was thankfully soon to leave this job at Amazon, he's like, that is what it feels like for me to be working. So how is it that at this time where we're surrounded by these encomiums to wellness and, you know, happiness, and, you know, few managers would say something like blessed be drudgery, you know, everyone's gotten the message, you know, you're supposed to be happy at your work. You're supposed to love what you do, to put yourself into your work. And isn't that so great? And the, you know, the reality for a lot of people is that it's not. And I wanted to understand why, you know, both by kind of fully sort of plumbing this ideology and the demands that it makes on us, but also by trying to kind of recover the sort of material reality of precarity and fear of the economic future that really kind of gives this ideology purchase. You know, that's it's not only, you know, a kind of exhausting idea, but it emerges from exhausting circumstances.
Well, I want to say one other thing before we dive into the history, which is something distinctive about this book, and I think important, which is your sources, the kind of materials you're working with here. And I think it's probably fair to say that the two main texts for tracking this ideology as it develops over the 20th century are sort of pop psychology and self-help books and pamphlets, and the people who propagate them as sort of gurus or public figures of some sort, or in some cases, ministers and preachers and stuff. But the other is this whole world of management theory, business school, psychology departments within business schools, management science. And you make this great articulation of the idea of some of these figures as sort of organic intellectuals of the management class in sort of Gramscian terms. So these are people who are incredibly eloquent in articulating the needed sort of ideology for manufacturing consent in workplaces as a managerial necessity. You have a line here where you say about these thinkers that they are distinguished from their colleagues by a higher order theoretical focus on the question of managerial legitimacy, by their interest in what might be called the managerial project. And so for listeners who are thinking about, like, what would you get out of this book that you wouldn't get from another one, it's that you're really engaging deeply with a set of sources that haven't been taken as seriously by historians who have thought about how American conceptions of work have developed over the course of the 20th century. Does that all sound correct, Eric?
Absolutely. You know, the question sometimes scholarly colleagues have asked about this project is essentially, who cares about this stuff? Like, this stuff is just so stupid. And, you know, in some cases it is.
But these are the best-selling books in American history.
Exactly.
Books like The Power of Positive Thinking, How to Win Friends and Influence People, Seven Habits of Successful People. Like, these are titles that everybody knows because they've sold millions and millions of copies.
Exactly. Exactly. And so we have to take them seriously. We have to figure out, you know, what they're saying, what people are taking from them, and also just the question of, you know, why.
One of my personal favorites, Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. I once told Sam, I said, you know, the main thing I remember from that book is there's an anecdote he shares where he was explaining why Franklin Roosevelt, FDR, was so, like, beloved by the White House staff. And he said it was because FDR learned the name of every single person who was on the White House staff. And Dale Carnegie then adds his own flourish. He says, a person's name is the sweetest sound to their ears they'll ever hear. So that was like one of his tricks to get ahead in life, was remember everyone's name, because no sound is sweeter to a person's ears than the sound of their own name.
When Matt and I do any kind of public event, he is so good. Matt just goes, they tell him their name, and Matt repeats their name. They say, oh, hi, David. Nice to meet you.
Or say, sorry, I couldn't hear you. Tell me what your name was again.
He says their name several times. He lets them say what they want. He makes them feel seen, and then moves on. Meanwhile, I'm like arguing with somebody about something they said. I think everyone is hostile for some reason. Anyway, Matt has benefited from some of this pop psychology.
There's actually an important point here, which is, you know, when we sort of analyze this stuff kind of ideologically, it's not that all of it is wrong per se. You know, a lot of this advice is like, you know, as far as it goes, if you want to, like, you know, make people like you and
get them to do things for you. I mean, that's
exactly.
That's what the science is.
Yes.
Yeah. It's not like we need to dismiss all of it on that level, but it's more kind of, you know, when this becomes the whole of life, like, what does that do to you? And what are the values that go along with it?
Yeah. You know, one of the really interesting kind of aspects of the story you tell, especially given, well, frankly, all of our interest in spirituality and religion, is some of the kind of origin story that goes back to even, say, Christian Science, right? Figures like Mary Baker Eddy, A Kind of New Thought. I think the connection to spirituality is something like, if you accept non-material realities, then your thoughts are as real as other things, right? Kind of the energies you're putting out into the universe. And it's striking how some of the texts you reference describe like little, almost like molecules of positivity or energy, right? That you can marshal on your behalf or control in some way or put out into the universe, it will come back to you. So, you know, those kinds of things. And just to give a sense of, again, personally, where I'm coming from, one of the things my dad told me a lot, he talked to me about a lot, was about how your thoughts could shape reality. And as he said, the mind cannot distinguish between fantasy and reality. So if you imagine yourself doing something, that's almost as real as doing it, was kind of the point. That kind of sense that the entrepreneurial work ethic being bound up with like creativity, positive thinking, putting your own kind of energies and insights and ideas into your work. What's going on there? What is kind of New Thought for our listeners? Why did you kind of start your story there, and what does it reveal?
So the most famous figure associated with New Thought in the 20th century is Norman Vincent Peale, whose book, The Power of Positive Thinking, is kind of still the best-selling tract in this vein, you know, and the title really, really sums it up.
It gives it away.
Yeah, spoiler alert. But, you know, that book comes out in the 1950s, and really he's kind of recycling these ideas that have been around since the late 19th century. You mentioned Christian Science, Matt, which is kind of part of the stew out of which this emerges.
And just for listeners, that's like, you can heal yourself, essentially, right?
Yeah, really this stuff is a kind of species of radical philosophical idealism in the strict sense, in that the material world is kind of illusory. And what's real is this kind of reservoir of sort of mental, divine, cosmic energy that's sort of beneath the surfaces of things. And so a lot of the early practitioners of New Thought were primarily interested in healing, in faith healing, overcoming physical ailments and afflictions. But, you know, by this kind of late Gilded Age period where I see the entrepreneurial work ethic starting to emerge, if you liked, you know, healing yourself physically using mental practices, you know, you're going to love getting rich using those same practices. And so just as illness is a sort of affliction of the material realm that you need to sort of think past, let the cosmic energy break through the obstacles afflicting your body. Again, if you just kind of transplant that into the economic realm, it really is in some ways kind of straightforward. You know, you think that, you know, just because you got laid off, just because there is no work for you, you think that that's the end of the story, but it's not. You know, if you relativize the material dimension of reality, you know, you can sort of summon all of this mental energy to overcome it and to make something new.
Don't join a union.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's kind of strange that we haven't kind of mentioned that yet, because obviously like a huge part of what manufacturing consent to different kinds of patterns of work is like, no, you don't need each other. You just need yourself. And maybe related to that, one of the people who very prominently adopted a version of New Thought into his own thinking and proselytizing was Henry Ford. He interestingly kind of straddled the eras and sort of discourses of the industrious work ethic and the entrepreneurial one. But if you're wondering, like, how did this kind of thinking get disseminated, not just by, you know, charlatans going town to town peddling books, but how about by one of the most prominent industrialists and employers in American life in the early 20th century, Henry Ford?
It really is hard to overstate how influential this stuff. I mean, these people were selling millions of books at a time where there were far fewer readers, you know, for the late 19th century. I mean, this is incredible. This stuff really is just everywhere.
So we won't go chapter by chapter, but the second chapter, I think, is important because this is sort of where you're describing the importation of German language social science into these kind of nascent business school environments, Harvard Business School in particular. I have to say that as I was reading this book, every time HBS comes in, I thought that some kind of like sinister music should play, like the Darth Vader's march or something.
Da-da-da-da.
So this is where we're filling in some of the sort of theoretical and academic underpinnings of this way of thinking in the early 20th century with figures like Weber, Sombart, Schumpeter, who we already mentioned. Could you just give us a gloss of kind of what these, you know, emigre thinkers who were either actually in the U.S. or that were being read by this new sort of science of management and what effect that had on the concept of entrepreneurialism and American work?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, the way that I stage it is to kind of try to show the way that these very eminent social scientists are kind of having this similar debate among themselves about the kind of predominance of material reality or intellectual ideational reality that these sort of new thought charlatans are having, but, you know, of course, in a much more elevated register. So one thing to note is that even though this is a peculiarly American story in some ways, the underlying forces at work in capitalism are, of course, replicated in all kinds of national contexts, including in Germany, which at the time is undergoing its own experience of industrialization, the formation of a mass working class. And so, you know, just as there are in the United States, there are social scientists who are trying to figure out the best way to deal with the social problems that result from these processes. So there's a similar kind of debate. You know, if we want to understand what is driving history in the biggest sense, but more particularly sort of driving the emergence of labor movements, making workers unhappy, should we sort of focus on their material circumstances, or, you know, should we kind of focus on their cultural or intellectual world? And the social scientists who are interested in subjective experience, they're really into this figure of, in German, the Unternehmer, which is translated to English via French as entrepreneur, the undertaker. And, you know, there's this, of course, you know, a lot of these guys are readers of Nietzsche, and, you know, they have this vision of this strong, charismatic leader who's able to kind of go above material circumstances, you know, create a new reality and sort of conjure up this kind of environment of passionate commitment to a shared project.
Eric, is this foreshadowing anything?
In Germany? In early 20th century? No, there's nothing that really comes to mind.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
You definitely do not want to look up what political party Werner Sombart supported in the 1930s at the end of his life. No, right. So, I mean, it's kind of stereotypical, but, you know, at the time, people don't fully know where this story is going. And so this vision is taken up in American business schools and, you know, often by people who actually are, quite frankly, sympathetic with these political projects of the European far right. And, you know, this becomes an opportunity. Again, you know, there are other figures in management theory who are focused on the material reality, whether that's compensation or some of the sort of physical details of the conditions that people work under. But this vision of the entrepreneur gets taken up as a way to say, you know, if we have the right kinds of people in management, again, it's all about kinds of people. You know, if we have the right kinds of people with the right sorts of virtues and capacities, you know, then it's possible to sort of spiritually transform the workplace, to sort of turn it into a place that's kind of energized again by this sort of shared commitment. You know, we're creating something new here. And so again, that's sort of where it links up with this broader popular culture of success.
And the important thing, obviously, is to get people invested via their, say, dedication to a charismatic leader in a corporate project which is not, you know, horizontally solidaristic, right?
Yes.
Like, I mean, they imported the thought of Vilfredo Pareto, who we've talked about on the podcast before, the sort of Italian thinker who you describe as is basically doing sort of managerial Gramscianism in the sense that he is sort of identifying these ingrained non-rational impulses, these quote unquote residues of common sense cultural notions in the populace, like in the working class, but that can be attached to, crafted onto the interests of capital instead of towards their fellow workers. But those ideas are entrepreneurial ideas. And these concepts of being vigorous and capable and, you know, and manly and, you know, part of a shared enterprise, like these are sort of cultural residues that can be mobilized by managers to get people to participate in a project which is about the product.
Yeah. So again, you know, we have to remember these are managers who are confronting a very different American working class than the one we have today, you know, in the 1920s and especially in the 1930s. They're very impressed by how much solidarity workers are exhibiting with one another. In particular, there's this experience of kind of spontaneous resistance to, you know, new sort of changes to the labor process that are being proposed, often without a kind of formal, you know, declaration of a strike. You know, they shut down or interfere with production in one way or another.
Especially when we're just trying to introduce a new machine to do things better.
Exactly. So this really, no pun intended, grinds the gears of the managerial class, and they're trying to figure out what to do. And they realize that this kind of impulse of sort of collective sentiment can be sort of useful for their purposes if instead of being channeled towards sort of protecting workers' way of life from capitalist interference, it's instead channeled towards a different shared purpose, which is created by the entrepreneurial leader.
Yes. You know, one thing I want to say here as a kind of side note, but I think it's important to me, one of the really true delights of your book, just as like a reading experience, but even more profoundly as an intellectual one, is the way your book provides this different angle into thinkers that, frankly, I know well and that many listeners of this podcast will know well, right? So we mentioned Weber. You talk about the Austrian economists, meaning the Austrian school, right? People like Mises, Hayek, Chicago school figures like Frank Knight. You know, I could go through a list of intellectuals we've discussed or mentioned on this podcast, but I just want to mention it for listeners, what an interesting kind of like side angle into somewhat familiar figures this book provides. And it, to me, it allows us to see their thinking really freshly, in a really like exciting way that's like, oh yeah, this actually draws out something from these figures that I hadn't quite noticed before, or it connects some dots I hadn't connected before. But you know, before we kind of get to some of the explicitly right-wing or libertarian or conservative thinkers that your book takes up kind of in its second half, I just wanted to say to me, before we get there, I wanted you to talk to listeners a little bit about the kinds of entrepreneurial work ethic jobs that kind of amount to being independent salespeople for pyramid scheme-like enterprises.
Avon, direct sales.
Yes, direct sales. Avon was the one I really wanted to mention because my mom bought and sold Avon at various points when I was a kid. I remember like waiting in the car, her dropping off some Avon shit at, you know, some other lady in our hometown's house. I was even thinking of the Mad Men episode, right? Remember Joan's friend who sells Avon? But, you know, I just feel like that is a really, really, really American phenomenon.
One thing listeners might be picking up on, and it's core to this book, and it's a contradiction, an antinomy that in fact entrepreneurial thinking is constantly trying to resolve, which is that we're going to be flitting back and forth between describing entrepreneurialism as a management strategy, as a strategy within workplaces for charismatic leaders to kind of manufacture consent amongst their employees. And then we're going to be going to this individual idea of the entrepreneur as anybody. You can be an entrepreneur. You can start your own business. You can make your own job. You can do direct sales. You can do Avon. And this sort of way in which entrepreneurialism tries to basically harmonize
the sort of psychological needs of workers and the material needs and management needs of the capitalist is what this book is about. So that sort of feeling listeners might be having of being a little bit jostled between these two registers is going to keep happening.
But that's the point in a way.
Yes. If in the section on Harvard Business School and management science, we're talking about like developing a way for leaders, corporate leaders to be in order to succeed and keep unions out of their shops and stuff like that. And then in the next phase, say, especially in the Depression, where we're talking about direct sales and Avon and stuff like that as a kind of conception of the self for the worker, that two-pronged expression, these different expressions of entrepreneurialism is part of the point.
That's why I began with the anecdote about Elon Musk and my father, right? Like, I think that like this is a key. I'm so glad you kind of reminded listeners of this. This is a key part of the story. The world's richest man and my father both can find satisfaction in their work by approaching a certain entrepreneurial work ethic and attitude. That's the seductiveness and power, I think, of what Eric's book is describing. So Eric, I'm interested for you to say more about this, but the figure of the kind of direct salesperson, what was it that before Willie Nelson made it as a singer and songwriter, he was like, you know, going door to door selling Encyclopedia Britannicas or yeah, something like that, right? Or dictionaries or Bibles or something like that, right? The door to door, like this is such a part of the American mythos. And it papers over these kind of contradictions in our economic order because it ends up saying, well, you know what? If you were creative enough, if you had a forceful enough personality, if you had the inner resources and kind of ability to really kind of peddle your wares effectively, you would be much better off. So it's just kind of like a where you ultimately kind of unload the responsibility, guilt, shame for your circumstances in life as well.
Totally. Yeah. And this is, I mean, my grandfather was a door-to-door salesman for many years. And so, you know, this to me is always, I feel like, an important and often kind of underappreciated other side of, you know, working class life. When we think about the history of the working class in the 20th century, you know, we think about unionized factory workers. And I mean, really, this is even at the height of the labor movement and the height of American industry, to be honest, a pretty small fraction of the American working class is actually, you know, doing stuff like that. There was instead a lot of people who were making ends meet in one way or another. And especially as we solve the problem of production, so to speak, and instead the problem of overproduction becomes what's really sort of constraining capitalist growth, the business of distribution becomes more and more central to how the workforce is composed. And so part of the way that demand is met is by organizing these sort of fleets of salespeople who are employed contingently in a way that, you know, does look a lot like MLMs today or the gig economy. And so, you know, part of what I want to do in this book is exactly to say the stuff that we think of as hyper-contemporary, you know, has much deeper roots precisely because it's a response to these really profound structural features of capitalist development. It's not just a kind of passing fancy.
And obviously for in this era, the Depression era, this notion that you can go and make your own job, it can anchor a sort of conservative critique of Keynesian solutions to the crisis, right? Because we don't need to use fiscal and monetary policy to get back to full employment. Regular people have the ability to create their own jobs if they just have the right mindset.
And Sam, not just regular people, but I do feel it's important, since I just kind of referenced the superficially egalitarian possibilities of this kind of mindset and approach, it's like, Avon, who are we talking about? Mostly women, right? Like,
might be people who are outside of the labor market already.
Exactly. It has this kind of weirdly democratic egalitarian thrust sometimes because it's like, you're a woman? Great, sell Avon. You're an African-American? Here's your opportunity.
You can sell these products to your own community.
Yes.
I think that's exactly at the heart of the sort of ideological and specifically political power of these ideas is, again, this kind of quasi-populism, as well as the kind of flattening of hierarchy, you know, through the sort of dissemination of this kind of identity or sort of way of thinking about oneself across, you know, these vast hierarchies, not just of class, but of race and gender as well.
So we're going to try to move along because we've got a lot of ground to cover, and this book is too rich to cover every single thing. But I did want to mention something I found really fascinating from the post-war period, you know, speeding past that little World War II thing, which is in your chapter on entrepreneurial modernity, where you talk about how the entrepreneurial ethic becomes conflated with a Cold War concept of democracy, as opposed to totalitarianism, or in some parts of the world, sort of like pre-modern cultures of work. What we're talking about is this sort of psychological reinterpretation of democracy that happens in the era after fascism has taken over Europe, because we start to think of democracy as a set of psychological virtues, as a particular way of relating and being a person, just as sort of the Frankfurt School had identified a fascist personality, right? And then in the American context, entrepreneurialism becomes conflated with the virtues of a democrat, the virtues of individuality and spontaneity and creativity that are unavailable, oppressed, beaten out of, say, fascist societies and indeed totalitarian societies under communism. Entrepreneurialism, it's not just a way of, you know, conditioning people to new and precarious moments in the history of work. It also becomes extremely useful as a sort of political ideology in this moment where, you know, American leaders are trying to identify their system, both of economics and their system of government, as, you know, distinct from and better than the alternatives in the world.
And as listeners to this podcast know, this immediate post-war period, I mean, this is like the era of popular psychology as well, right? So we should kind of expect this. And it's not just the kind of entrepreneurial mindset and ethic that's conflated with democracy in some ways, as opposed to the authoritarian or the fascist personality, but also, you know, this is the era of the organizational man, right? This is the man in the gray flannel suit, like the era of like how our psychologies interface with these big mid-century institutions and structures and processes and forces. And it's inflected in this entrepreneurial way as well.
And the organizational man stuff really represents sort of the fear of the same kind of forces, or a version of the kind of forces that had taken over in other parts of the world, you know, sort of overly rational bureaucratic processes. But Eric is very smart in pointing out that the anxiety about that possibility in the American context is really an indication not that entrepreneurialism had fallen out of favor, but that it was being called upon to solve a problem once again.
Exactly. There's an entrepreneurship for every season in this book. And what I try to show is that there is still an entrepreneurialism, even in the heyday of the organization man and the gray flannel suit, and sort of our kind of stereotyped image of this post-war period as one of bureaucracies sort of stifling the individual. You know, of course, there were plenty of individuals who were stifled in the post-war period, but there was also, you know, often precisely in reaction to that, a deep current of entrepreneurialism that helped Americans narrate this progression from the depths of the Depression into post-war prosperity, which is often something we kind of skip over. You know, it was the Depression, and then all of a sudden we have the post-war boom. But precisely in that transition, there's a moment of change that, you know, for all the political reasons that Sam was just describing, it becomes very important to sort of narrate as a triumph of entrepreneurialism. But then it is true that, you know, there is a kind of new economic order that's created. And in the boom era, you do see elements almost of kind of industriousness sort of rearing its head as work for some people in some communities becomes abundant again. But of course, it's not to last. And eventually we sort of arrive in this period, the wheel sort of revolves again. And this period in the late 1960s, 1970s, this kind of new post-war order that, you know, people imagined as the kind of the fruits of the entrepreneurialism of the 1940s and early 50s, it comes into crisis again. And, you know, work becomes scarce in a lot of geographies, a lot of communities. Good work especially becomes scarce. There's, you know, even for people kind of in the professional class, there's a sense of not having the opportunities available to you that you would have wanted. And that's always great fodder for the entrepreneurial work ethic.
Well, I mean, this can get us into the kind of era of the counterculture, and in particular of the countercultural entrepreneur. I was really struck by the line you identified in the Port Huron statement, the SDS statement from 1962, quote, "Men have unrealized potential for self-cultivation, self-direction, self-understanding, and creativity."
Speaking of Mad Men, I was struck by the Mad Men episode when, you know, they hire the young guys to do the jingle for that coffee company, and he goes into Don Draper's office and starts reading him the Port Huron statement about creativity. He's like, this is what our generation wants. You want to sell coffee to our generation? You got to read the Port Huron statement.
And the interesting thing about this that Eric argues here is that, like, while the Port Huron statement is supposed to be the expression of this anti-capitalist, countercultural movement of the young, actually that sounds a lot like the culture. Because official liberalism in the post-war era, well, also praising those virtues, the virtues of self-cultivation, self-direction, self-understanding, and creativity, but expressing it through the entrepreneurial idiom. So even from the very beginning of the counterculture, even before a counterculture even really existed, its expressions bore the sort of the residues of entrepreneurialism, and which would find its full flourishing in, say, to keep the Mad Men going, you know, the Coke commercial that comes at the very end. But, you know, less kind of glibly and less blatantly manipulatively, this idea that the dissatisfaction that the kind of highly educated young might be feeling in the post-war work environment, that they could find meaning through work by doing good work, or doing work that was expressive of their identities, whether, you know, starting a health food store or working for Ralph Nader.
Yeah, totally. Again, so if you're a young person in the 1960s, you know, you're raised with the again, the official sort of oracles of society telling you that these virtues, you know, creativity, self-development, this is essential to what makes America America and not the Soviet Union. You know, this is essential to being democratic. And yet, when people arrive, you know, at universities, you know, arrive in the kind of the corporate world, they find a very different reality where it seems like those things, there actually isn't room for any of that. And so, again, you're sort of posed with this similar kind of dilemma. There aren't the opportunities you want there to be, so you have to make them yourself. So again, this takes a variety of different forms. You know, on the one hand, there's these kind of more explicitly politically reformist projects like the sort of Ralph Nader nonprofit network. But there's also this whole sort of world of kind of lifestyle merchandising. Again, you mentioned natural foods. Listeners who are interested in this dimension of the story can read an excerpt from the book about the grocery store Erewhon in The Baffler that's out now. But then also the kind of personal technology industry. And this is an element of the story that's more familiar, the kind of path from the counterculture to the world of Steve Jobs and the sort of early tech Silicon Valley guys. But it's, you know, what I try to do is to sort of re-embed that journey in this bigger kind of milieu of young idealistic people trying to figure out how to get a working life that sort of lives up to all of these ideals about the relationship between work and democracy and individual flourishing that had been promulgated for decades before that.
I mean, Eric, there's more we want to discuss, but just kind of listening to you here, I mean, we've been so critical, you know, along the way. I kind of just wanted to insert here a note of, like, to me, it's really understandable that people would want their work to have some kind of creative fulfillment for themselves. Like, they want to think that what they show up to do every day has meaning, that it somehow relates to their lives and their ambitions in life in meaningful ways. It's very understandable, actually, reading your book, why this kind of entrepreneurial work ethic and kind of the ideological apparatus around it, why it has met with some success in our national life, in our history, in our culture.
It's also, as Eric pointing out, the entrepreneurial work ethic feeds on its own failure to deliver, constantly regenerates itself by failing to deliver. So in all these different moments and in different idioms, this world of thought tells people that they can and will and ought to and later on absolutely need to find satisfaction in their work and create their own
job, and then they're dissatisfied. But their expectations for that have been raised by this way of thinking about what it means to be a worker and what it means to be a human being. And therefore, the solution becomes more, ever more entrepreneurialism. And when you add in the material dimension here, which is that these ideas are arising to, you know, harmonize some contradiction in the patterns of American work, you know, why does it satisfy people? Or at least why does it satisfy people for a time or cultivate in them certain kinds of longings? Because that's what is needed. If they weren't to do so, then the economy would fall apart. I mean, that's the perspective of the managers. And obviously, you know, this is getting ahead of ourselves. But of course, you know, the alternative to this would be that people were not just permitted but encouraged, and our sort of political economy made space for people to find meaning in their lives, not in their work,
right,
not
yes.
exclusively in their work, not exclusively in their work, you know, elsewhere, you know, with our families, with our friends, with communal projects, and so on.
You know, one of the things that I, especially when, Eric, in some of your materials in your book, the chapter, you know, where you discuss Steve Jobs, you know, at some length, for example, and, you know, Silicon Valley and some of the kind of California startups and tech companies as the kind of embodiment of, we want creativity. We don't want typical manager structures. You know, we're going to work incredibly hard and insane hours, but it'll be worth it because of what we eventually produce. You know, I remember one of the things that really stood out to me was, I don't know, a couple years ago now, Sam and I did an episode on the Grateful Dead and conservatives with our friend Sophie Hagney. And, you know, one of the criticisms, which was a justifiable one, which was in that particular episode, we didn't talk enough about the quote unquote California ideology. And I do think, like, maybe like a hinge that connects some things here is like libertarianism. Like the Grateful Dead's fandom, I think, has a distinct libertarian edge. And there's just a way in which, like, the move from entrepreneurial work ethic on the left, creativity, fulfillment, you know, the connective tissues between that and then more kind of right-wing libertarian entrepreneurial work ethic ideology, which, you know, we're going to discuss in a few moments. I kind of feel like libertarianism is the weird connective tissue in some ways.
Not for nothing, the Grateful Dead was one of the most profitable touring bands of all time.
Jerry Garcia was out there selling ties, man.
Yeah, he was an entrepreneur.
Yes.
Many times over. I think what Matt's saying is true about the shared libertarian ethos, but I think what's distinctive about the new right entrepreneurs we want to talk about, and here, you know, just to put some cards on the table, we're going to be talking about Walmart, we're going to be talking about McDonald's, we're going to be talking about the Koch brothers.
Amway, baby.
Amway. We're going to be talking about Amway. They paired entrepreneurialism explicitly with social conservatism and Christianity. So still, the importance of finding yourself and having your work be expressive of your core ideals and your core values. But what are those values? Their Christian values.
The Christian nuclear family.
Exactly. I mean, we kind of have to think back to this moment in the 60s and 70s, and elements of this persist to this day, where a lot of white conservative Christian Americans really did view themselves as a kind of counterculture or subculture, sort of put upon, at odds definitely with the sort of mainstream values promoted by kind of corporate society. So there is a kind of a similar kind of mirror where, you know, if you're really self-consciously invested in tradition and, you know, right-wing Christianity and conservative family values, at this time, you're likely to think of yourself as in a weird way, a kind of rebel. You're committed to things that, you know, are tolerated at best, or, you know, even kind of repressed by the sort of liberal East Coast establishment. And so this does set a fire under some of these sort of new right political actors who are also successful business executives. And for them, they do develop a vision of entrepreneurship as sort of allowing them to invest their work with these kinds of conservative values, much in the same way that contemporaries think of entrepreneurship as a way to invest their work with kind of liberal or progressive values.
Eric, in particular, you know, one of the aspects of your book that I found most fascinating was your connection between the major themes and topics of your book, which we've been discussing, and, as I briefly alluded to earlier, Austrian economics. Figures like Friedrich Hayek, von Mises. Those are the two principal ones that come to mind that our listeners would be familiar with. What was the place of the entrepreneur in Austrian economics?
It was foundational.
Like, unusually so. Like, in a way I did not appreciate before reading your book. I'd read, like, listeners know, my Econ 101 textbook was literally Man, Economy, and State by Murray Rothbard. Like, I'm not a lightweight or kind of like totally unfamiliar when it comes to Austrian economics, but I do remember reading some of the material in your book, Eric, and it, like, something snapping into place, like, this is 100% right. Like, there is something you need to understand about how they understand entrepreneurs to get what the Austrian school is really up to.
Yeah, so often, you know, the way that Austrian economics is described, you know, what's at the heart of it, the concept of the market is very important. And, you know, of course, they were really fixated on the market and had some idiosyncratic views about the nature of the market and what it was all about. But they were just as fixated on the vision of the entrepreneur. And it was precisely because of the special properties that they ascribed to the entrepreneur that they were able to have such a kind of miraculous view of the market, precisely because you have a market populated by entrepreneurs who are not just kind of reactive, passive agents, but who are creative and innovative and sort of always kind of scanning the environment and looking for new opportunities to seize on. This is exactly why the market performs these functions of integrating information into prices and, you know, leading to ever greater prosperity and everything that the Austrians think markets do.
I mean, someone like Hayek's maybe most famous contribution to our purported understanding of things, right, is as like free markets as information exchanges. Right. And kind of, especially when it comes to price, like dispersed information across an economic landscape, right, that no single mind could possibly possess. So in some ways, the entrepreneur is almost like the adept, right, the connoisseur of market dynamics, who can read what's going on and creatively respond to it in a value generating way.
The other component of this, and something that I try to emphasize, so in, you know, in terms of this kind of new right world, the most important self-conscious expositor of Austrian economics in the management world is definitely Charles Koch, of Koch brothers fame. And so, again, a lot of attention has been paid to, you know, his views about the importance of markets in relation to his political projects, you know, his work with his brother to sort of advocate for so-called free market policies, kind of at a governmental level. But again, this worldview also implies a lot about the way that firms themselves need to be run. And, you know, Koch really picked up on this and tried to operationalize it.
Yeah, it's called market-based management.
Yes, right? Exactly.
It's kind of like, if free markets are so great, why don't we kind of apply those principles to the internal organization of our company?
And this was an objection, for example, that the socialist economist Otto Neurath made to Hayek. You know, we can't do central planning. Well, to, you know, tell that to corporations. And, you know, Koch is someone who actually takes this objection quite seriously and says, you know what, you're right.
I mean, I can just say, this doesn't reveal anything because it's been long enough now, you know, damn near 20 years. But when I was a young conservative, I was very close with a number of kind of Hayekians who worked for the Institute for Humane Studies, right? The Koch-backed center at George Mason University. And I remember, because a couple of these guys who worked there were pretty close friends of mine. And like, I'd go to these 2-week summer boot camps, libertarian boot camps. And like, at some point, inevitably, we'd be, you know, a few drinks in some night at the happy hour, and they'd start bitching to me about they're having to undergo these market-based management seminars as part of their work. And they're like, Matt, it is so dull. It is so fucking stupid. I can't stand it. But like, Charles Koch was so committed to, I think, proving what you're saying, that actually the objection didn't even apply internally, right? There can be no valid objection to market economics. So Charles Koch was going to go to the hilt to prove that even in the internal functioning and organization of a company, of a firm, of an organization, the free market principles would work, but it just made the lives hell of the employees who had to sit through these ludicrous seminars on how you could apply free market principles to like running this libertarian nonprofit think tank.
Yes, exactly.
You know, it's like, yeah, right, sure, okay, buddy.
What's interesting about these new right expressions of entrepreneurialism to me, which Eric, you point to, is that from a certain perspective, the kinds of entrepreneurial ideas that we've been talking about up to this point would seem a strange fit, they seem a natural fit for Austrian economics, but a strange fit for like Christian identity and traditionalism, right? Because up to this point, we've been talking about the entrepreneurial ethic as this transformative, disruptive force. It's especially associated with sort of East Coast business schools, with sort of stuff coming out of the war on poverty in LBJ's White House. It's associated with the counterculture and New Age philosophy that we were talking about a moment ago. So how does entrepreneurialism become grafted onto ideas of the Christian family in this era, which from a certain perspective would seem like an unnatural fit? How can entrepreneurship still be about the future and about transformation, about modernity, when it's being invested with ideas about restoring the past or preserving a lost kind of stability in the family?
Yeah, there really is an important paradox here. I think that part of it is these figures, you know, Sam Walton, Ray Kroc, Van Andel, and DeVos, they're able to kind of pick up on certain strands that were always there, you know, even if they were never dominant in the business schools or the Washington bureaus. So Norman Vincent Peale, of course, is a conservative Christian. You know, a lot of the sort of New Thought world does try to kind of synthesize, you know, entrepreneurialism with a certain kind of religious traditionalist outlook.
And Henry Ford was Henry Ford.
Yes, of course. Exactly. I mean, so Henry Ford is actually a great comparison, because he also had a kind of vision of sort of restoring the past through creating a new future. You know, he thought that it was precisely by sort of having his own kind of, you know, dynamite, revolutionary, successful business that he could sort of restore these lost values of hard work and proprietorship and everything. And that was exactly what these new right entrepreneurs later in the 20th century also understood themselves to be doing. So I think part of, you know, why it works is the environment of economic crisis. You know, on the one hand, these are businesses that in many cases seem to be succeeding enormously at a time when many other older, more established corporations are failing or struggling. And so this sort of lends them this kind of veneer almost of the kind of old entrepreneurial innovation, while simultaneously their kind of internal culture being committed to these old values. The other piece is the new organizational mechanisms that they devise or adapt. You know, these firms are often structured in a new way, or they take old ideas and do new things with them, whether that's, you know, franchising in McDonald's, a variety of different schemes that they have at Walmart to sort of promote kind of local store-based management. Of course, the MLM distributorship structure and independent contracting in Amway. So, you know, on the one hand, these are kind of new-ish ways of organizing a big corporation. But their substance, you know, what they do is to kind of give this sense of kind of more local control, proprietorships, almost kind of small business ownership, kind of old school family capitalism, but it's reborn in the big corporation. And it's precisely this sort of rebirth that is what's new and entrepreneurial.
Well, I mean, one way that really concretely this new right entrepreneurial vision offers a sort of restoration of the family is that something like Amway, you're doing it with the family, right? You know, you enlist everybody in the family in this ultimately very bleak proposition of instrumentalizing all of your relationships into, and then getting everyone in your life to buy into this basically cult-like scheme where you become indebted to the company and then have to keep recruiting more people in order to stay afloat. But in principle, and for many people who did it, it was nice because, you know, the father isn't having to leave the home to do it. You're doing it all together. Even the kids can be involved. The McDonald's franchisees, you know, the ideal franchisee is a husband and wife couple, right? And even something retail like Walmart, I mean, yes, ideally both husband and wife work at the store, or they're involved in the store within a store program to try to end up opening their own Walmart or whatever. But even if one person is going to work, there is this thing you point to, which is it's offering this alternative to other kinds of work, industrial work, that took the father figure further away and probably wore them down a lot more than the work they might be able to do just at a Walmart.
I mean, it's the promise of flexibility, right? The siren song. I mean, I can honestly say, since I mentioned my father already, I remember exactly how old I was when my father quit his factory job to start his own business, because I was 10 years old, which is to say, I had 1 year of Little League, and my dad had to miss a couple games because he was working the swing shift at the factory. And he hated that with the passion of a thousand suns, right? Like the fire of his hatred for missing my Little League games. And he worked more hours owning his own business than he ever did at that damn factory. But you know what? He could go to every single one of my Little League games. And the kind of exchange between flexibility and responsibility, but also a certain amount of freedom, right? That's kind of the Amway model, the franchisee model, right? Like you will pour yourself into the enterprise to make it work. But if it does work, you'll be able to go to your kids' Little League games instead of pulling windshields out of a furnace at 2 a.m.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And again, another example of the way that I think it's important to sort of uncover the kernel of people's desire that this stuff all responds to. You know, what can we learn from the success and the appeal of entrepreneurial ideology about, you know, what people want out of their lives, you know, even if they're not actually getting it from Amway?
No, and you know, Eric, one of the things that occurred to me, I think we've kind of intimated this already, kind of suggested it, but maybe not articulated it exactly, is the way in which one of the things I love about your book is the kind of way the entrepreneurial work ethic, the ideology around it, kind of papers over the contradictions in our economy every step of the way. It kind of provides some way to kind of resolve these problems that people are facing, structural problems, really. And one of my senses is the way it kind of all just kicks the can a little further down the road. Right? Like the Amway model, it technically is not a pyramid scheme, like as found by some federal court, because technically when you enlist people under you, right, to start selling Amway shit as well, it's not like you sign up this many people, you get this many dollars. It's like they actually have to sell shit, right? And you get a cut of that. So that's why it was not technically a pyramid scheme. But even something like the franchise model, it's kind of saying like, okay, I'm just pushing the kind of responsibility for making it all work a little further down the road, right? It's not really mine anymore. You've bought the franchise. This is your problem. You know, you are my Amway underling, but now it's your job to sell this crap and or signed up more people to sell the crap. There's just this very fascinating way in which it kind of like temporarily resolves the contradictions and tensions and problems while just sort of like pushing the responsibility for it all a little further away, a little further down the road.
Yeah, I used the metaphor of a spiral in the introduction, and I think that's exactly the dynamic. Again, the sort of the limits or the, in some cases, even the failure of today's entrepreneurialism provide the kind of raw materials for the appeal of entrepreneurialism tomorrow.
Yes, that's so well said.
We didn't mention that this is a regional phenomenon too, right? McDonald's is being expanded in the South and Southwest. Walmart stores are being opened in these sort of exurban spaces between small towns that wouldn't otherwise be able to sustain a big retailer like that. Amway is taking place in sort of small town culture, and that's really core to what DeVos and Van Andel sort of conceive of it as doing, cultivating these small town values. So, you know, this is Reagan country in a very serious way.
That's also part of the story of, you know, how you sort of reconcile the traditionalism and the innovation. Because again, for a lot of these corporations, part of what was often framed in media profiles as their kind of brilliant new idea was the idea that you could make a ton of money and have a modern cutting edge business success in that geography. you know, that itself is in some ways a kind of new, a genuinely new idea of these executives, and part of the way, again, they kind of smooth over these contradictions. We're sort of marshaling all of our new business expertise in order to make it so that you can live where your family has always lived, go to the same church your family's always gone to, you know, and still have a good life economically.
Yeah. And the other point, and this may have already been implied enough by what we're talking about, but for the sake of Know Your Enemy listeners who are interested in, like, why is the country so conservative? How did it become so conservative? Take the Kochs. Like, we focus so much on their funding of, like, political philosophical think tanks and straight up lobbying initiatives on behalf of libertarian economics. But how much more important might it be that they're cultivating and training and really indoctrinating thousands of managers with this way of thinking about what capitalism is? Think about Amway. I mean, we've talked about what the business model is, but just as important, both for the founders and for what it actually manifested as, was just all these kinds of ideological confabs. Like Amway, you're being hammered all the time by the literature about having a Christian family and working hard and the sort of total kind of harmony of those two impulses. Basically, what I'm saying is that, like, if you want to understand how it is that Christian conservative ideology gets disseminated in this moment in time through these forms of economic enterprises, the literal training that people go through to be a part of them, and then go out and become their own little proselytizers of this way of thinking about American capitalism and the American family. This is where it happens.
Yeah, completely. And they're proud of this fact. You know, they advertise it. There's this one piece of Amway literature that I describe that is quite explicit about it. You know, you're a kind of ambient counterculture type of person, and then you start selling Amway, and, you know, soon enough, you're a kind of doctrinaire lockstep conservative. You know, this kind of alchemy is exactly self-consciously what they were aspiring to produce.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can say when I was a young conservative, I actually met Dick DeVos, Richard DeVos, because he was a major funder, first of all, of the Heritage Foundation, right? There's a lot of Amway money that was poured into the Heritage Foundation, DeVos money and Van Andel money. And I remember I went to this big intercollegiate study institute, which he put a shitload of money into. And I went to this big gala with him. You know, he had funded a bunch of stuff and funded an award that was also given that day. And then that let him, at some point in the proceedings, have the mic for, you know, a half hour or so. And DeVos ended up owning the Orlando Magic, remember?
Yes.
And he talked about the financial advice he'd give to the players. And I just, there was some part of me that was like, what's your advice? Start a pyramid scheme? Like, you know, fuck you. Like, come on, buddy. Like, I know what you, how you made your money. It's Amway. Fuck off, you know?
You know, the final thing I would want to say about Amway is that it's not just that they're disseminating these ideas, but also, and Eric, your book makes this clear, like, what kinds of qualities does Amway want to cultivate in their leaders, cultivate in their sellers? You know, it's people who are capable of inspiring optimism and loyalty in a risky endeavor.
Perhaps in the face of reason.
Yes, and it's ideally people who already effectively lead by the force of their charisma and personality many other people in their lives, right? Because you're able to sell to those people and you're able to recruit those people. What are we talking about? They're effectively recruiting organizers. People who have a natural capacity for organizing and then sending them out in the world to organize on behalf of Christian capitalism. But, you know, if we want to think about the flip side of this, like, what kinds of resources in the American character are being cultivated, manipulated into participating in this entrepreneurial endeavor instead of, say, another endeavor, you know, Amway's parasitic on the American instinct for solidarity. It's parasitic, and maybe all of entrepreneurialism is.
I mean, the Harvard Business School guys in the 1930s understood themselves quite explicitly as doing exactly that, as we were talking about earlier.
And not for nothing, the Kochs literally fund the entire right-to-work movement,
yeah.
Which tries to convince people that it's actually the unions that imperil your sort of creative self-becoming, your sort of masculine virtues, the virtues of determination, perseverance, and creativity. It's the unions that undermine your individuality.
And in fact, Sam, as my father explained to me many times, actually before he left his factory job, unions were for the people who didn't possess the qualities of the creative entrepreneurial figure, right? They were for the weak workers, the dumb workers, the lazy workers.
Or the merely industrious.
Yeah, yeah, the merely industrious. Those who said, blessed be the drudgery, right? That was how unions were explained to me. My father, I mean, he was implacably opposed to workplace unionization, because he was like, I don't need it. I'm one of the creative, hardworking, entrepreneurial ones. I'm not one of the lazy shitheads who needs the union to protect them. And I think it's hard to understand the United States without realizing how much the entrepreneurial work ethic is not just an alternative, but like holds out some kind of other possibility, like some way out of the dilemmas we face economically in this country. Like, you don't actually have to choose if you believe an entrepreneur can kind of break through to the other side in some creative way that moves past the impasse without structural change.
Yeah, again, going back to New Thought, you know, the foundational principle is that what seemed to be immutable material constraints is in fact a kind of illusion, a trick your mind is playing on you.
Right.
And I would just say, you know, I do think it's so interesting. I mean, Eric, I kind of suggested and asked you earlier, the dynamic you described, to what extent it ratchets up, right? Kind of increasingly spends down any humane capital kind of in the order of things such that like our very lives become our jobs now, right? In the realm of influencers. And I was thinking, it seems so appropriate that like in this moment we're in now, we've just elected again, someone like Donald Trump, who is like the ultimate scammer and entrepreneur in some ways.
All he's ever sold is himself.
And frankly, like in some ways, you know, since the November election, how should I put it? The risk, the kind of bet that was placed by voters was that like things were bad enough that however horrible and bad Trump is himself, it'll still be better choosing that alternative. I also think you could frame the dilemma as something like, who is a Trump voter? Someone who would rather take an entrepreneurial risk than dare to change anything structural, you know? Like maybe this one guy, because of his creative leadership, can move us past this impasse.
Yeah.
Well, and this is what people mean when they talk about Trump's business experience, or, you know, they hope Trump will run the government like a business. They don't mean that he's going to like implement Workday or something, you know, like
not even run it well.
Right. He is going to be an entrepreneur to sort of marshal all these kind of heroic attributes assigned to business leaders by this ideology.
And inspire it in the people, Americans, to see a further horizon for themselves as well.
I mean, the element of vicarious participation, which is central to the whole strategy of entrepreneurial management, is also, I think, completely foundational to MAGA. Werner Zombart, one of these German economists, says something like, you know, in the firm that's led by an entrepreneur, the workers talk about the firm as we rather than it. You know, it's something that they belong to, they participate in. And so that, you know, the firm's success kind of is their own. And I think, I mean, just based on my own experience and observations of people who've gone down that route, the most diehard MAGA people really do feel like, you know, Trump's success is their own. They're kind of
yes.
participants in this project. And, you know, when he wins, they win. There's a real, I think, kind of deep analogy there.
Totally. I mean, you really do have to ask yourself, like, what is otherwise the kind of psychic payoff for voting for Trump, right? Because if you kind of like acknowledge that certain material indices, right, aren't going to change immediately, like the price of eggs or things like that, you're like, hey, like, what are they really gaining from it? What is the source of satisfaction they have in seeing him win? Part of it is, of course, they get to trounce their enemies, watch the libs cry, drink lib tears out of a mug. But I think identifying with him and the successes of the creative entrepreneurial leader being their own, the we, not it, I think there's something to that.
And this idea, the sort of sense of anticipation, I have a friend who talks about Trump time. You know, MAGA people live in Trump time, where it's all always about what's going to happen. Trump exclusively speaks in the future tense. You know, we will do this or that. But that's also exactly the kind of temporality of of entrepreneurialism. You know, it's all about what the entrepreneur will create.
The power of intention.
Exactly. Like Trump is, he is always about to crush his enemies, drain the swamp, whatever. Just in the same way that, you know, these Silicon Valley companies are always about to become profitable finally.
He lives in an eternal present. And as long as there's always something good around the corner, then everyone can live there with him. I don't know if we mentioned this yet, but who officiated Donald Trump's first wedding?
Norman Vincent Peale.
The power of positive thinking. And when you read that stuff, you can see that whether it's through him or through his business associates, through his father, Norman Vincent Peale was friends with Fred Trump. Trump, to the extent he has a kind of metaphysics, it comes from that stuff.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
100%.
I mean, the idea of the primacy of thought over matter and the power of intention, that it's all about mental state and sort of the energy you put out into the world, a winning mentality. Like, that is all that he has, you know?
We're going to win. We're going to win again, Sam.
Yeah, and not for nothing, Peale's 1937 book was called The Art of Living. And I have a quote written down from the book where he says, "You will do your best work and be happier if you resolutely put worries and fears of the future out of your mind." You know, don't worry. Don't be worried. Just be happy and know, you know, that it's all going to work out. I mean, that's Trump's whole message. That seems to be how he lives his life.
I mean, I do just have to say, come on, the very fact that Norman Vincent Peale presided at Trump's first wedding, tell me, does an angel not ride in the whirlwind and direct the storm? God exists. This is not coincidence. Nothing happens by chance.
Well, you could attribute it to God or to the very, very carefully explained history in Eric's book. I said this to Eric already, but another example of the cunning of history from recent times is Trump cosplaying, LARPing as a McDonald's employee while arguing against the minimum wage from the drive-thru window to a reporter. This is the entrepreneurial ideology in visual form.
I have to say, the thing about Trump's McDonald's turn that at least once a week since it happened crosses my mind is when he was describing how when serving the French fries, they never touched the human hand. And his fascination with hygiene. And yeah, that was what he commented upon. That is so fascinating to me. And I'll just say the origins of fascism are not that far separated from the discovery of germ theory.
Well, and there is a kind of fascination with the sort of mechanical miracle of the McDonald's system. I mean, in Trump's beautifully childlike mind, there is preserved the kind of amazement with which many Americans did experience the McDonald's production system.
The efficiency of the McDonald's, yeah.
Again, at the same time, this thing that seems very kind of traditional small town America is also, you know, in its own way, very innovative. It's the future, the past and the future reconciled.
This is maybe one of the final takeaways for me of the book, that maintaining a kind of eternal childlike presence, which is also always amnesiac because you have to forget. In order to encounter these entrepreneurial cliches as profound and helpful and something that will give you a handhold to make something of your life again, we have to constantly forget how many times we've heard them.
The past is behind us. The future is uncertain. But the present is a gift.
Exactly. Trump's eternal childhood is, I think, totally symptomatic of the entrepreneurial mentality. There always has to be something new and good and amazing about the idea that you can make your own job, that you can find creative satisfaction through work, that all you have to do is change your mindset.
Yeah, this is really one of the oldest ideas in modern America, and yet it still seems so new. And near the end of the book, I provide all these examples kind of throughout the ages of people saying something like, we've come up with this great new idea called being entrepreneurial. Like, finally, for the first time in our era, we're recognizing the importance of being entrepreneurial.
1910, 1920, 1930, 1940.
You know, it's extraordinary. There is this sense of ritual amnesia.
You know, the feeling that I have watching these sort of Silicon Valley gurus, entrepreneurs, the sort of threads I see on Twitter that are just repeating these nostrums ad nauseum is I think like, oh my God, this stuff is so banal. It's so stupid. It can't possibly still inspire a hope for the new and for the innovative and for the future. But God damn it, it does. I mean, you know, idiot success win guru podcasters just elected Trump president for a second time.
Yeah.
So the hope that this ideology will lose purchase. I mean, the only thing we have to rely on is the growing clearness that its material rewards are illusory.
Totally. The promise of the entrepreneur in American life is a little like Eli Cash in the Royal Tenenbaums, right? Everyone knows Custer died at Little Bighorn. Yeah. What this book presupposes is maybe he didn't. You know, like maybe your life doesn't have to suck.
Tobias Funke in Arrested Development, where they're talking about opening their marriage and they say, well, it doesn't work for most people, but it might work for us.
Yes. Well, Eric, really and truly, your book was incredible. I loved reading it. I hope our enthusiasm, Sam and I's enthusiasm, has come through to listeners.
I hope it didn't prevent you from talking too much.
Yeah.
Our enthusiasm.
We had a lot to say.
No, it's when you write a book, you never know if readers will pick up what you're putting down. And this conversation is great evidence that at least two readers really, really got it.
Well, I'm glad. We really loved your book. Once again, for listeners, it's called Make Your Own Job, How the Entrepreneurial Work Ethic Exhausted America. Eric Baker, congrats. Thank you so much. Thank you for this conversation. And we really, really, really hope our listeners pick up your book.
Thanks so much.
Help Eric keep making his own job. And hey, sign up for our Patreon, by the way.
Yes, if you were inspired by this conversation, you're listening to three small business owners.
This podcast, it's really just an expression of my truest self. You know, I get so much satisfaction from it. All right, Eric, thank you so much. I echo everything Matt says. This was great.
Thank you both.
Thank you, listeners.
Catch you next time. Ciao, ciao.
Bye-bye, bye-bye. Thank you.